Before I do the reading, I just want to give a little bit of a context. On Thursday, I got an email from Pam and said, "Hi, Robert, would you be available, willing to serve as presider for the service this Sunday? Since this would involve mainly shepherding the joys and concerns and so on." And then she goes, I gotta get this thing to go. Also, if there's a reading you'd like to offer on the topic of wholeness, excellence, and perfection, that would be welcome. Yeah. So I said, oh, okay. I said, sure, no problem. I just happen to have a volume of readings called Everything You Wanted to Say About Wholeness, Excellence, and Perfection, but we're afraid to ask. So, of course, I had to go to the good book, which is Google. And then I Googled wholeness, excellence, and perfection. And interestingly, it had two of the three. So for wholeness, it had complete, which I thought was interesting. For excellence, it had good. But perfection, it had perfection, which, you know, it's kind of tough on that one. But then for some reason, the word quality came to mind. And I don't know if anyone's read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, but it's about this author, person, who goes insane trying to define quality. But quality is interesting, and for him, it sort of boils down to the Tao. And so I thought, there's no better book than the Tao Te Ching. So that's the background of all this. I have no idea whether it has anything to do with the sermon. Verse 45 of the Tao. True perfection seems imperfect, yet it is perfectly itself. True fullness seems empty, yet it is fully present. True straightness seems crooked. True wisdom seems foolish. True art seems artless. The master allows things to happen. She shapes events as they come. She steps out of the way and lets the Tao speak for itself.
So I'd like for us to share a time of silence right now, maybe the time it takes to enjoy 6 or 7 deep breaths for meditation or prayer as you choose. I find it deeply comforting to be breathing all together with you all, y'all, in this room. So I'd like to start by calling to mind, each of us, a person in public life, maybe more than one, someone you admire. Someone you follow in the news today, or someone who stands out in the historical record, someone you might hope to emulate, an artist, a performer, a politician, an athlete, a writer, a religious leader. For me, Thomas Jefferson is such a person. In the early 1990s, our family visited Washington, D.C., Williamsburg, and Monticello, Jefferson's home near Charlottesville, Virginia. In Williamsburg, we bought a day pass, but we didn't have time to attend the tour of Jefferson's garden, which was led by an actor in costume impersonating Thomas Jefferson. The next day, the children and I planned to go to the morning show, and we hoped they would let us in with our tickets from the previous day. I begged the person checking tickets, saying we had come a long way from California, and we were Unitarians like Jefferson. I admire him so much, I said, and I meant it. She let us in. Our 11-year-old son, who's now a lawyer, was impressed by the way I even invoked tears of passion in my effort to influence this gatekeeper. When we visited his lovely hilltop mansion at Monticello, I bought a Jefferson Bible at the gift shop. He had edited the New Testament to omit all the supernatural elements. I asked the volunteer cashier about rumors I'd heard that Jefferson had fathered children by Sally Hemings, the enslaved half-sister of his wife. It was believed by most historians at the time that the father of these children was a nephew of Jefferson's. It bothered me that a person I so revered might have behaved so badly. I knew he had owned enslaved people, but for some reason that seemed normal for a man of that time and place. I also knew that other slaveholders had enslaved women as concubines and profited by the labor and the sale of their own offspring. It disturbed me that it might also be true of my hero, Thomas Jefferson. So guess what? A study based on DNA evidence concluded in 2001 that the allegations were most likely true after all. Jefferson had been the father of all six of Sally Hemings' children. Since then, I haven't felt the same about him. It feels almost as though he has betrayed me personally. I do still appreciate the beauty of Monticello's architecture and the gardens. I'm grateful to Jefferson for promoting tomatoes and coffee in the American diet. I admire his writing and his statesmanship. Does his moral failure vitiate his many important talents and accomplishments? I've noticed in our dominant culture a tendency to idolize leaders, to let our admiration balloon into idolatry. We have a tendency to strive for perfection and perfect success ourselves, and to require anyone in a position of power to be possessed of faultless motivation, intelligence, and integrity. So what about your heroes, the ones I asked you to call to mind just a minute ago? Have any of them disappointed or betrayed you? How does that influence the way you think about their accomplishments? Does it change your desire to enjoy the fruits of their good works or emulate their good qualities? I wouldn't for a moment suggest that we excuse destructive, oppressive, immoral behavior. We must name it, learn from it, and avoid it for ourselves and for the sake of our community. What I question is the purpose and validity of judgment and blame that condemn any person unconditionally. In the words of death penalty abolitionist sister Helen Prejean, a person is more than the worst thing he has ever done. The cultural norm to embrace is to embrace a responsibility to criticize and judge ourselves and other people. The culture defines perfection, and we learn the hierarchy of qualities at a very young age. We all know what perfection is, says Unitarian Universalist minister Sean Denison. Perfection is young, it is white, it is male, it is healthy, it is able-bodied, it is thin, it is athletic, it is heterosexual, it is Christian, it is economically comfortable. End of quote. We Unitarian Universalists affirm and promote the worth and dignity of every person, as well as acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth. If we condemn people for their moral lapses, if we deny their capacity for growth and learning, how easy it is then to judge on other grounds as well, on criteria unrelated to deeds. We have witnessed how easy it is to judge based on unjust rankings, stripping others not only of worth and dignity, but of voting rights and of life itself. It's clear to me that there's a strong link between judging others and judging ourselves. The link may be even stronger when we focus on the flaws and mistakes of leaders. What is the remedy? How can we let go of self-criticism, blame, and perfectionism? What power can we invoke to overcome the fear of failure that keeps us tethered to tedium and discontent? How can we effectively nurture our individual and collective flourishing and creativity? Here are some things to keep in mind about perfection, excellence, and wholeness. The pursuit of perfection traps us in fruitless longing, feeling unworthy and inadequate. Human perfection is not attainable. It is an illusion. A perfect thing is without flaws or mistakes, absolute, unchanging, artificial. Nothing alive can be perfect. Our dominant culture sets us up for failure and disappointment by driving us to strive for perfection. The influence of perfectionism is reflected in comparing ourselves with others, never a helpful strategy for personal growth. We might find perfectionistic self-criticism lurking in the excessive emotional energy we invest in our opinions about others, whether positive or negative. When you catch yourself judging another person, this may represent a dimension of envy. On the other hand, it could reflect an implicit recognition of some trait of your own. Either way, you're cut off from genuine connection with that person. We may aspire to perfection, believing it would compensate for our fear, anger, and vulnerability. Since achieving perfection is impossible, we always experience some degree of shame in falling short. As my yoga teacher back in California says, "I'm not perfect, but parts of me are excellent." Though it's not an absolute measure like perfection, criteria for excellence do produce rankings. Excellence is linear. It involves going beyond what is sufficient or enough, getting an A rather than a C or even a B. Striving for excellence can promote growth as long as we don't let ourselves slide into perfectionism. While perfection tends to be a narrow target, there are many ways to excel in a given context, whether it's cooking or dancing or organizing or swimming or singing or gardening. It's possible to excel while you're still learning, and then go on to excel further. Wholeness is entirely different. Spiritual and communal, as well as physical and mental. Wholeness can't be measured. It embraces all parts of every person and every situation, light and dark, lumpy and smooth, happy and sad, clean and messy. We don't have to achieve it, but as human beings, we have the privilege and capacity to recognize and appreciate it. Wholeness includes loving, procrastination, craving for sweets, vulnerability, forgetting people's names, beauty, running late, integrity, courage, connection, compassion. When we become aware of the lure and symptoms of idolizing the perfect, when we grow weary of striving to excel, let's remember to pause and call to mind our own wholeness, our own holiness. Those words are etymologically related. Let's do the same for those around us, loved ones, co-workers, leaders, and friends. Let's remember Thomas Jefferson participated in enslaving human beings, and also that he cultivated varieties of peas for the beauty of their blossoms as well as for their flavor. I close with these words from Mary Oliver. It's a poem called Messenger. My work is loving the world. Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbirds, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums. Here the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing, since all the ingredients are here, which is gratitude, to be given a mind and heart, and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all, over and over, how it is that we live forever. So may it be.